This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 24th of June 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 89th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today's presentation is a mixed media celebration where we're spreading our talents across the disciplines. First, Katie hopped the bird to the Côte d'Azur for International Adland's slightly infamous jamboree, Cannes Lions.
So much goes on. It is so big. It is somewhere you have to be. You have to be seen. You have to seem to be seen.
The wonderful, multi-talented and frankly legendary Japanese composer and sometime pop star Ryuichi Sakamoto tells us about his new record and his life in music.
Music is the same, but each time we play, it changes, of course. It's alive. Music is alive.
And we visit the artist who masquerades as a postmodern librarian to make her works. I promise you, you will know what this means in time.
Part of what I like about this project is winding up somewhere where I don't really know what's going to happen. I have a methodology and I have a certain amount of time and I have a system, but what actually comes from that is different every time, and that's why this project keeps on going.
Plus, we'll welcome Canadian electronic superheroes Austra in for a Midori House session. We'll ask why paper is punching above its paper weight and get all mystic in the mountains of Morocco. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Austra are a Canadian band mixing the gothic majesty of operatic vocals with the less expected bedfellows of synths and icy electronica. Their new album Olympia was out last week, and the gang popped by to see us at Midori House to give us a taster. And to kick off the show, here they are with Home.
You nodded it hits me when you don't come home at night. You see it is better than beating on the bitter side. You nodded it hits me when you stay away at night. What is it that keeps you there? Keep
That was Ostra with Home, and we'll, of course, have a little bit more from that fantastic session later on in the show. First up this week, we're grabbing our sunglasses and heading down to the French Riviera, because last week the world of creative communications, or advertising to you and I, headed down to Cannes for their annual summer holiday, the Cannes Lion Festival of Creativity. 2013 marks the sixth decade of the event, and with 12,000 delegates in attendance and a record 36,000 entries for their much-coveted Golden Lions, it's an industry that seems in good health. Nowadays, brands, marketing agencies, technology companies, and A-list celebrities mingle with agencies from every corner of the globe for a tactical spot of business over a glass of rosé or a chance to give their fellow creatives a strong, drunken pat on the back. Well, producer Katie was there last year to find out what it was all about, and she's not one to turn down a day trip to the sunshine. She hopped aboard a plane last week to find out what was new at this year's event and what 60 years of advertising have taught this forward-looking industry.
So much goes on. It is so big. It is somewhere you have to be. You have to be seen. You have to seem to be seen.
As the sun blazes down in Cannes, Murray McLennan is enjoying some fresh grilled sea bass and salad, sitting in a quiet outdoor restaurant overlooking the Mediterranean. The global CEO of M&C Saatchi has been coming to the Cannes Lion Festival of Creativity for 15 years. But he's a busy man. So busy, in fact, that he's hardly ever near the Palais Festival.
I'll make a confession now. I actually don't go to anything at the festival at all, on the basis that I can always get hold of most of that content later. What I would rather be doing whilst I'm here is meeting with journalists, meeting with influencers from key countries, so the US or Asia or China in particular, interviewing people as well. And then, of course, these, I think what one's meant to call it is the networking events. In other words, parties on the beach. But it's important to be seen there as well, I think. You know, at Saatchi and M&C Saatchi is a brand we like to be talked about.
And they're not the only ones. 5 minutes down La Croisette Strip, outside the Palais Festival Conference Centre, brands, agencies and technology companies from the world of creative communications are all trying to get noticed. There's even a man dressed as an Egyptian mummy playing a small pink Barbie guitar next to the huge inflatable yellow cat. Coupled with all the shorts and t-shirts, it's hard to tell where the land of holidaymakers ends and the 12,000 delegates here for the festival begin.
Hi, would you like some free pizza?
Jeff Sweat from agency Deutsch LA whizzes past on a scooter. He's devised a simple strategy for making an impression. Be there for people when they need it most. Come midnight, Jeff and his team of two-wheeled pizza angels, as they've been called, will be delivering free margaritas to groups of drunken revelers spilling out of the bounty of late-night parties. Well, it's all about good ideas, right?
Deutsch LA is well known in the US, but not globally. And so we wanted to let people know who we are, but we also wanted to let them know that we're an agency that's very inventive and full of decent people and, you know, frankly, the person who brought you pizza in the morning in your time of need.
And are you thinking already that you might want to do this next year?
I'd like to, if it continues to go well and if we think we're going to have a presence here next year, that's certainly something we consider.
And perhaps you'll vary your toppings or maybe even introduce a new product like a hot dog or...
The hot dog might be difficult, but we are seriously considering pepperoni.
Inside the monolithic Palais Festival, a cacophony of seminars, workshops, talks and award ceremonies are taking place throughout the week. But for this year only, there's also a quiet oasis, a place for reflection, perhaps.
And I tell you what, tick, followed, talk, followed, tick, followed, talk, followed, tick.
The Game Changers exhibition, part of a surprisingly subtle 60th birthday party for Cannes Lions, is a rare opportunity for the forward-thinking world of advertising to examine its past, as Philip Thomas, CEO of Cannes Lions, explains.
The kind of thought processes and the insight and the strategy behind some of those pieces of work is exactly the same as is happening now. You know, they changed the game. They looked at the world in a completely different way, whether it was the guerrilla campaign for Cadbury or Think Small or any of those famous campaigns. And I think what we were saying was there's absolutely no difference between Red Bull throwing a guy out of a space station and then him parachuting to Earth. There's no difference between that and Guerrilla, because Guerrilla was game-changing. It was a TV spot, but it changed the world of advertising, and Red Bull doing that also changed the way people communicate. So I think it's very important to look back and see how the industry's developed and just reflect on what an extraordinarily different place it is.
I can't believe I ate that awful.
I hate two Alka-Seltzer.
Alka-Seltzer neutralizes all the acid your stomach has churned out.
Different indeed. It's not just about traditional advertising either. Hence why this year's speakers have included Sean Combs, or P. Diddy as you may know him, Lou Reed and Annie Leibovitz. Philip tells me Hollywood will have an increasing presence in years to come. To reflect this changing industry and generate some extra income, 10 new prize categories have been added in the last 8 years. 2013's new kid on the block is the Innovation Lion, designed to award innovative and revolutionary technology. Scooping the top prize were New York-based Barbarian Group, whose open-source software, Cinder, is already having a huge impact on the industry, albeit in the background.
This means a lot to us because, like, we are actually trying to do something that's like an evolutionary step from where advertising has been. You know, like, that's actually like the actual part of advertising that's really interesting to us. And so this is, I guess, a validation that we're doing it right, you know? But also, it's just the thing that I'm the happiest about is that now a few thousand people that never would have known what Cinder was now know what Cinder is, and now there's going to be more cool things that happen in the world because of that, you know?
Just down the strip, in the bustling, sparkling foyer of the Carlton Hotel, sits Barbarian Group's founding entrepreneur, Benjamin Palmer, and his executive director, Colin Nagy. Last year, Colin was one of many people excited about Nike's Fuel Band.
I was expecting to see more continued innovation in terms of products, and I saw a few things here and there, but not as many as I would have liked. So I think that belies a larger truth about the difficulty of this for marketers and traditional agencies.
But there is one continuing trend which is inspiring him.
Because the kind of connective tissue of media is getting more and more and more tight, we're continuing to see a trend where you don't need to have the $1 billion media budget to kind of carpet bomb the world. There still are examples of things where if they're good enough, they can kind of bubble up and be shared and reach a critical mass without, you know, a tremendous amount of media spend or so on and so forth. So there is more and more of a meritocracy, and I think a lot of that is enabled by technology.
Dumb ways to die. So many dumb ways to die. Dumb ways to die. So many dumb ways to die.
Take Dumb Ways to Die, for example, which has been viewed over 50 million times online and at one point reached number 6 in the global iTunes chart. McCann, the small Melbourne agency behind the idea, have picked up numerous awards, including a gold in the radio category. Despite essentially listing a catalogue of bizarre death scenarios, it's a strangely endearing cartoon animation and a catchy song created to promote safety on Melbourne's metro system. They're not the only agency from the city with strong ideas. Ant Co is Executive Creative Director at Clemenger BBDO.
Our clients are inspired by it, agencies are inspired, but so it just raises the general level of advertising in general, and that's what we as creative people love that. It's a bit like the Olympics of advertising, this festival you've probably noticed. And because of that, I think countries tend to band together a little bit. I think people who would otherwise compete, they become even more friendly in this environment, which is sort of a funny thing to watch.
So with 60 years of prize giving already behind us, how do creatives keep coming up with that currency that dictates everything? Original, effective ideas. Back at the restaurant overlooking the Mediterranean, global CEO of M&C Saatchi, Murray McLennan, gives his insight.
When things catch hold and take over the world, maybe from a brief moment of time, but not always, they can catch hold for months. And I think that's what fascinates creative brains now, is what can be the spark that can catch fire and take the world by storm.
I asked him how you predict what that's going to be in this era of technology, multiple platforms, celebrity, and complex branding. His answer, it ultimately comes down to what it has done for over 60 years. Instinct and good judgment. For Monocle in Cannes, I'm Katie Bilboa.
Be safe around trains, a message from Metro.
Thank you, Katie. And to see the full list of winners from this year's Cannes Lion Festival of Creativity, just visit cannlions.com. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're from Ads in Cannes. We shift now to music from Japan. But like all music, it's kind of really from everywhere, all at the same time. Ryuichi Sakamoto is one of the key figures in pop music's transference into classical, into electronic, into jazz, into performance art and video. The classically trained Japanese star studied electronic music at Tokyo's University of Art, where he experimented with synthesizers in those early days before finding huge commercial success with the Yellow Magic Orchestra and soundtracking and starring in one of my favorite, as if that makes any difference, movies Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Since then, collaborations, solo works, and groundbreaking live performances have kept Sakamoto-san on the cuttingest of edges. He was in London last week to perform with regular pal Alva Noto at Yoko Ono's Meltdown Festival, as well as to tell us about his beautiful new record called Three. And frankly, he honoured us by coming in to see us at Midori House.
This particular collaboration with Alva Noto is a little complicated because it starts with my piano improvisations. So all the music is based on my piano improvisations. And I kept sending the improvisations to Alva Noto. Then he kind of cooked with it. So that's basically the what the music is. So to represent that music on stage, I would say half of music on stage is improvised still, based on the improvisations, but still improvised.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you have you've roughed it out in some exactly. way, and it's a thing has formed, a record has formed, a performance has formed.
Right.
But presumably, it's lovely as a musician to be kept on your toes, to be finding exactly. some new entry point into and exit point out of these
exactly.
compositions.
Right? We need freedom.
New compositions on it. There's some yeah. tracks that you're exceptionally well known for. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence mm-hmm. was the yeah. most wonderful soundtrack to that great film. What happens when you revisit these things? They're a different riff on it, aren't they?
Right.
What was the genesis of deciding to do old stuff and do new stuff next to it?
Right. Well, basically the songs on that album Three are the repertoire we normally play these days.
You know, this is the Ryuichi Sakamoto trio.
Trio, yes. Yeah. In the case of my solo piano solo concert or with the violin and cello, sometimes with an orchestra. But I play those songs normally, combined with the old stuff and new stuff. Obviously, arrangements are different for the different ensemble forms. Mm-hmm. So this album 3 was recorded at the end of the tour we did. In 2012 in Europe. Uh-huh. Normally, we make an album, then go on the tour.
Yeah, this is the wrong right? way around, right?
Right?
What's going on here?
Well, because during the tour, the music is polished and it gets grown up. So why don't we get the best time of the music, which is at the end of the tour?
Not for the first time, Ryuichi Sakamoto has invented a brand new way of doing something. This is the... And what's it like, as we said, the new compositions on the record are very handsome pieces, but some of those things that stand out on the first listening are obviously the things that we've heard before. Mm. How do you feel about going back to that sort of thing? Because obviously these are things that your fingers play in your dreams almost, you know, because you know them so well. So maybe the rest of the trio, the musicians that you play with, sometimes they get a little bit nervous when they're handling something that's so well known.
Right. Well, like, for example, probably the song people know, you know, among my music might be the music for Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And for a while, you know, I didn't want to play it because it's too famous and it's kind of too corny.
Yeah, right. Well, you get stuck in a thing.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, yeah. I want to, you know, get away from my past. So, but then at the point, I listened to the music back and then it's good music. I decided to play again and then music is the same, but each time we play, it changes, of course. It's alive. Music is alive. So that's a good thing. It's a different from like the art, like the painting. You know, once it's done, you know, it's
done.
Doesn't change.
It just depends on who looks at it and what they get out of
it. Exactly. But the live music is different. Maybe music is composed like 100 years ago, but then when it's played, you know, it changes. It breathes. That's a good thing.
Before we go, and before we cut back to the record very briefly, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to go back into the mists of time. They'll put a sound effect maybe on that. We're going back into the mists of time. I wanted to ask you about, you studied electronic music at Tokyo University of Art. That must have been, you must have been one of the first people to have done that. That must have been quite an interesting vibe back then doing that. What was that
Yes.
Like?
Well, around that time, well, which was around 1970, you know, the synthesizers were so expensive, so it was impossible to purchase by an individual. Luckily, the university I went to had three huge wall-like synthesizers, you know, Buchla, Moog, Arp. So I kind of sneaked into the class and, you know, played with them. That helped me a lot.
That was Ryuichi Sakamoto, and his new record, 3, is out now in most parts of the world. Just go to sitesakamoto.com to find out more. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where after this break, we'll be paying homage to paper.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the time shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're heading down Sloane Square Way to see the Saatchi Gallery's new show called Paper. Oh yeah, guess which medium they're all about right now. Paper's a funny one, maybe. The most readily available, malleable, foldable, transportable, and like the budgie, cheap materials an artist could possibly use, but something maybe misunderstood as ephemera or the poor relation. The show challenges our ideas of what paper is, how it can be used, what form it can take, and how it can trick us cunningly into thinking it's something else. Before we go to the gallery itself, the director of the Saatchi Gallery, Philly Adams, swung by Midori House to rustle some paper next to our microphones and shine a little light on the show.
Well, the thing with paper that it's, you always think of that it's a very traditional medium. And that was the fun for us as we've been collecting works heavily based around paper. And it was a couple of the major works that threw the doors open to seeing how many works and artists we had working in this medium. And we've got 44 in this show. And there are a number of artists that we weren't able to fit in. And some of these major works are very, very playful. paper has a real power about it, and it has strength, and it can be in so many different forms. And I think this show really highlights that in a very playful way.
And I presume it's also the first mark an artist ever makes, no matter how old they are, wherever they're making notes, wherever they're doing a sketch for anything.
Yeah.
It is about the back of a fag packet, or it's a notebook. I mean, yeah. It is paper. It's all about paper.
Right? A child has put their first sketches and crayons, and it's something that's already always readily available to anyone.
Right, now we're down amongst the works. Take a right as you walk into the gallery, and you'll be struck by a 6x2 metre frieze of heavy symbolism, witty illustration, and political engagement. This is Dominic McGill's Makadima, a huge work that spans more thought and history than it even covers the wall.
I did this with a friend, Murat Chemanguk, who's a history professor in New Jersey, and we used to meet once a week, and even before we started doing this, we talked endlessly about, you know, the build-up to the Gulf War, then the Gulf War, and then the whole politics of terrorism. And finally we just said, oh God, we just got to do a drawing. And we all just do it once a week. And we'd come in and we'd say, look, I've got this great bit from this book. We've got to use this. And we'd put it on a card, stick it on the drawing, and then they'd put something next to it. And then you go, oh, wow, if we use this piece over here with that, then there's a kind of friction between the two things. Yeah. And you start to realise, you know, that all meaning is really fragile. It can go, you know, depending on what it's up against. We were all sort of very interested in sort of theories of history, you know, parallel histories, histories that sort of cycles that repeat themselves. So many people have written so much about different theories of history. So in this we have Ibn Khaldun, which this piece is named after, who wrote this book called Makadima, which is the sort of introduction to a sort of philosophy of history. Then there's a lot from Baudrillard, from Virilio, from all over the place, from the Quran, from Marx, from much more right-wing stuff, Francis Fukuyama. Yeah. There's something nice about this sort of fragility of paper and the fact that you can just throw it away.
What about the form that paper can take, though? Colombian artist Mila Lagos made what looked like wooden branches out of layers and layers, leaves and leaves, perhaps, of the Colombian daily newspaper El Tiempo, called Fragmentos del Tiempo, Fragments of Time. Get it?
I came to this kind of sculpture because I was thinking about prints and about how the image can still alive through be printed several times through the years. And I was looking at the beginning engravings from Albrecht Dürer and of the drawings of Leonardo da Vinci. And I say, those drawings come from 5 centuries ago and is still alive. And how many paper has been used to keep the image alive? It takes a long time because I have to recycle paper. Later I have to organize the paper and prepare the paper to be carved and glue it and sew it. It's the same process to do a book. The only thing at the end, it has the shape of the log, but it has the behavior of the one book.
Brooklyn-based artist Dawn Clements makes huge detailed ink drawings that are filmic in their scope and subjects. Paper's her thing. Maybe she couldn't quite do this on any other medium.
I start usually on a piece of paper that isn't this big, a small piece of paper. I think for this drawing, I started just drawing that little chair in the center on the bottom. And then I just keep adding on paper and travel. I sort of crawl across the room visually and just keep adding on paper as I go. And I fold the paper as I go so that I can continue to work on a little table. I don't do them on the wall. The folds are part of the process so that I can work on them when they're a manageable size. And this is made with black Sumi ink and a brush. Drawings can be, and traditionally speaking, I think, are the kind of workhorses of the art world. And so I really use drawing in that way as a way of thinking aloud. And you're right, I do sometimes actually crawl across the drawings as I'm working on them. And the nice thing about a folded thing, too, is that you can open it up and see the whole thing. You know, in a traditional style Western book, you turn the pages and you can't really see the whole book at once with a folded, for instance, with an accordion fold. You can look at it page by page, but you can also open it all up and see it all at once.
That was Dawn Clements showing at Saatchi's new show, Paper. And the show's on in London all summer. Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more of that inspiring Midori House session from Austria. We'll meet the woman curating the world's libraries in a rather interesting way. And we'll travel to Jujuka for a spot of Moroccan mysticism. Too much for you? Don't worry, I'll be here for the ride too. That's me, Robert Bound, on this here Culture Show on Monocle 24. So first we head back to Toronto via Midori House for some more electronic beats and rousing vocals from Ostra. They played from their new record Olympia, and after one of the loudest sets we've ever had here at Midori House, Monocle's Tom Hall joined singer Katie Stelmanis in the quiet of Studio 2. To kick things off, here's Painful Like.
I think I have some sort of musical understanding ingrained in my brain, but for the most part, I try and forget most of the classical training because I find the classical training is pretty, there's a lot of limitations. It's hard to be creative in the classical world, so I try and leave as much as possible behind me.
Yeah, but anyone who's heard your music will be able to hear, I think, obviously, an influence in, am I right, you've been trained operatically with that voice.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find when you were coming up through the Toronto music scene, was that something that sort of set you apart and made people take notice, or was that something that maybe you felt a bit self-conscious of? How did that feel?
Yeah, I guess it's always kind of been the thing that people notice first. Yeah, I guess I've just always been kind of like the girl with this really big voice.
And I wanted to ask about the new album, Olympia, and also, I mean, the name of the band, Austra. Am I right in thinking that's your middle name?
Yeah, that's correct.
But it's also the name of the Latvian goddess of...
light, apparently.
Light.
Yeah.
Okay. And so there's these really quite big mythological themes maybe going on here, because Olympia is obviously, you know, where all the gods in Greece hung out back in the day, if they ever did. Is there something that you're trying to convey there, like a sort of an otherworldly sense? Are you kind of into that mysticism? Or?
I would like to say yes. I am indeed into mysticism, and I like the idea of the land of Olympia, but unfortunately that isn't actually where the album title came from.
Right.
It's a much more earthly story. it was dedicated to, like, a close friend of ours had a baby during the time we were making the record, and they named the baby Olympia.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
It all happened kind of simultaneously, so we decided it was a good way to commemorate this new life and new album.
Right. I thought you were going to say it was something like Olympia, Washington or something, which is even more kind of run-of-the-mill.
But that's kind of cool. Like, that's why I also like the name, because it has all these other connotations. Like, I love the connotation to Olympia, Washington as well. It's kind of like an homage to the 90s Riot Girl scene.
And I wanted to ask also about Toronto, where you guys are from. I mean, do you think you're very typical of that music scene? I mean, I know that you're on Paper Bag Records out there and Domino here, and Paper Bag's sort of been kind of instrumental in quite a few bands' careers, like people like Broken Social Scene and things like that. Are there any other bands out in Toronto that we should be looking out for at the moment that are maybe coming up that we'd have no idea about?
Yeah, there's a band called Diana, which is really awesome. They're actually opening for us on our American tour in September. Carmen L is the lead singer of the band. She used to be in my band, actually, a few years ago. So she's awesome. She's really good. I feel a little bit out of touch now because I've been touring for so long, so I don't really have a grasp on the Toronto scene. But I know that there's a generation of people that are a bit younger than me. Like, they're mostly all Dorian's friends. Dorian's, like, 3 years younger than me.
Right.
And they're all, it's like this, I don't know, they're all amazing musicians. It's this whole group of friends. And I've known them since they were teenagers. And I remember when they were teenagers, I hated them. I thought they were really annoying. But now that they've grown up a little bit, it's just this, I can't think of the right word.
It's like a resource almost to draw on.
Yeah, it's like a resource of amazing musicians. And, you know, it's like Doldrums is in there as well. Again, like this band, Diana, Johnny plays in Tassiomancy. Tassiomancy is in my band, and Johnny's now off playing keyboards with Tegan and Sarah, and just a lot of brilliant musicians.
That was Austria's Katie Stilmanis talking to Tom Hall. The band's new record, Olympia, is out now on Domino Records, and they're playing loads of dates across the summer. AustriaMusic.com will be your first port of call for the informations. 20 years ago, New York-based artist Nina Khachaturian was getting her Masters of Fine Arts, and she and a group of her classmates went to a house on the coast of California to do a project with exactly what was there, nothing else. Nina chose the library, and her Sorted Books series was born. The series works like this. Nina goes into large libraries, be it private homes or specialised public book collections, grouping the titles into clusters so that the books can be read in sequence from top to bottom or left to right. Funny sentences, insightful reflections, representations of a time and place, all these arise from the clusters she creates. Tania Katenjian spoke with Nina at a gallery in New York.
It's a very language-based project, but I would also say that the most commonly misunderstood thing about this project is that it is only a writing project or only a project about language. And one thing that's also extremely important is that I'm working with physical objects. These books have heft, they have weight, they have color, they have font and typeface, and all kinds of temperaments come into these sentences that I'm constructing using the titles because of that. And I'm always thinking about the books as physical things that in their physicality carry a kind of meaning too.
Well, particularly when you see it in this room, we're actually seeing all the covers. One of the ones I'm looking at because of the direction that I'm facing is If Youth But Knew the Old Knowledge at the Time Appointed.
That's my dad's favorite one.
I'm not surprised because my grandfather used to always say, if si jeunesse savait si vieillesse pouvait, if youth knew, if the old could.
Oh, wow, that's really poignant. Yes, yes. There is a wistful kind of tonality to a lot of the books in this collection, and I found that really interesting. As I began to work with them, I noticed there was a kind of melancholic tone, a little bit like with that one you just read. There's another one on that same wall that says, Friendship, the Silent Places Where Speech Ends. And that's one of my favorites, actually, I think, in this group. And I've thought a lot about how with someone you've known a really long time as a really dear friend, it's sort of okay to sit in silence. And to me, that became a way of sort of speaking to maybe also different conventions of friendship then and now.
So tell me some more of your favorites that happen to be in this room.
There's one high up on this wall here that reads, Indian History for Young Folks, Our Village, Your National Parks. And that one was important to me because in the Delaware Art Museum book collection, I had a moment one day. I'd been working with the books for a couple days in a row, and I kept thinking, you know, why are there so many books about
the brave native or the sort of the noble savage chief so-and-so, blah, 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 blah. Like, there were just copious numbers of these kinds of books. And I kept thinking, you know, why now? Why at this end of the century moment are these books being published in such quantity? And I was trying to kind of find a historical reason for that, I guess, having never really thought about that before. And it sort of dawned on me that at this point in time, the Native American population of this country had been basically so thoroughly decimated that it was possible to start romanticizing these people again. And it was sort of a horrible moment of going, oh my God, these books are present, and the sort of attitude towards these people has shifted to this because of something really terrible that happened to them. And so I wanted there to be a book cluster that really spoke to that. When we had the exhibition here last weekend and the book signing, it was really fun for me to see which ones people responded to, and that was one of the ones that a lot of people pointed out as a favorite. So that was nice for me. There's one actually right next to that one I just read to you, which goes, "Somewhere in France, the Anglomaniacs meet the Germans." And that one was, I hoped, a way to speak to the presence of travel literature in this collection, because, you know, for the first time, people own cars, and there's a lot of motoring around. There were lots of books about sort of the motor car this and the motor car that, and a kind of adventuring that people, the middle class, I guess, the growing middle class is able to do that hadn't really been possible, perhaps, in that way before. And, yeah, I wanted one book cluster that would sort of sum that up. I mean, I think sometimes for me, I start with a pretty strong gut feeling about something, but then part of it is also not knowing exactly where it's headed. And there was sort of a light bulb that went off a little while ago when someone asked me, how come you've never sorted your own books? Because I've worked in, you know, 10 different book collections now over 20 years doing this project, and I've become very familiar with a sort of process that works for me of stepping into a library that I've never set foot in before and beginning to kind of do this exercise. So someone said, well, why have you never done it with your own books? And I couldn't really answer it. And then somebody else said, maybe it's because you already know what books you have and there's no surprise. There's no sort of potential for surprise in that way. And I thought that really is at least part of the explanation, is that part of what I like about this project is winding up somewhere where I don't really know what's going to happen. I have a methodology and I have a certain amount of time and I have a system, but what actually comes from that is different every time. And that's why this project keeps on going. I mean, it's at its 20-year anniversary mark now, but I am imagining I will be doing it still 20 years from now, you know. I don't intend to stop.
That was Nina Kachadurian talking to Tania Katenjian. And if you're interested in seeing the collections for yourself, the book Sorted Books is published in the US by Chronicle. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We'll finish the show by going a bit left field in Morocco next, so do not go away.
In a region typified by change, Istanbul is in the middle of a renaissance of its own. Monocle Films visits the historic city to witness its contemporary metamorphosis.
Battles over the projected identity of Turkey on the landmarks of the city translate into protest. While disagreement over the future exists, pride in the changes is not in short supply.
Istanbul Inspired, a film about change in an ever-changing city, on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. Berber Sufi trance music has been ringing through the southern Rif Mountains for thousands of years. When one group from the village of Jujuka was discovered by Canadian painter Brian Guisin and American writer Paul Bowles in the 1950s, there began new mythologies that combined infamous beat figures and rock and roll fandom with remote Moroccan mysticism. Every year since 2008, a small and intimate festival has been held in the village, and, as Saima Tarek discovers, the legend of the masked musicians of Jujuka is still going strong.
After Brian Guisin discovered the master musicians of Jujuka in 1951, he said he wanted to listen to them every day for the rest of his life. With Moroccan painter Mohamed Hamri, he opened a Tangier restaurant where members of the masters became the house band. It was here that legendary beat figure William Burroughs first heard the wild folk music from this remote mountain village. Burroughs later dubbed them the 4,000-year-old rock and roll band. The Rolling Stones came to Tangier in 1967, and Hamri introduced Brian Jones to Jujuka. Jones also fell in love with music and returned the next year to record them. Trumpet player Ornette Coleman followed suit in the 1970s. Western curiosity about the group, who play reed, pipe and percussion that relies on improvisation and complicated rhythms, has only grown. In recent times, the Masters have opened Glastonbury Festival and played the Villa Medici in Rome. Djuka Festival organiser Frank Rinn, a writer, musician, curator and producer of three records by the Masters, tells me how it all began for him.
I first came across the Master Musicians personally when I organised a William Burroughs and Brian Gyson art show in Dublin in 1992. And through Brian Gyson's friend Terry Wilson, the English writer, I was connected with Mohammed Hamri, a painter who was from Djuka and had been a friend of Brian Gyson and William Burroughs. And I contacted Hamri and invited him to the show to exhibit. And Hamri said that no show about Brian Gyson could be complete without the Master Musicians of Djuka, who were Brian's favourite band. They were really sweet people, and at that time there was a big controversy erupted with another group from the village that were doing commercial work. And it stuck in my head, and Hamri kept inviting me to come down and see Djuka for myself and see what the situation was and the musicians in their own village. So in 1994, I got a deal with Sub Rosa Records, and I came to Tangier, hung out with Hamri, and then we went to Djuka for periods of 10 days to 2 weeks at a time. And I recorded two CDs with the Masters over a period of about 3 months. So in 2005, I came back, and in 2006, we went to Portugal and did a show. We had a lot of trouble getting the visas, and I thought, well, look, if visas are a hassle and cost a lot of money, and you're not making money going out of the country because there's so many musicians, also there's this controversy still going on, why not bring people to the village and they see what it's like for themselves, and each person becomes an ambassador for the music, and they feel the special connection with the Masters.
There is probably no other festival anywhere based on the premise of watching the same band for 3 days in a row, with guests spending each night at the musicians' homes, and unless they are fluent in a very specific kind of Berber Arabic, communicating with everyone solely through gestures, smiles, and of course dancing. The annual Djuka Festival involves an entire rural community practically untouched by modernity. The music heard here was purportedly given to the village in the 15th century by Sufi saint Sidi Ahmed Sheikh. The Master Musicians today are a 10-strong wall of noise, playing traditional instruments such as raita horns and tibble drums non-stop for hours. Ahmed Attar, the representative leader of the Masters, who evokes a Marlon Brando-like quality, tells local school teacher Khadbach Muhammad a little about their process.
In the house of a musician, they stay together alone. All of them, they take a flute. They don't play first time with the pipe, with the flute. And they make one of them, they learn a new note. And he teach the others how to play it. And all of them, they learn the same note. After that, they take the pipe. Who has this note in his mind, he began to play. And the other, they go with him in the same tone to give a new sound.
Every year, some people come back again, and every year there's new people. And over the last 6 years, we've had an amazing collection of people, visual artists, musicians like Robert Hampson from Maine and Loop, young DJs, students, old people who want to get into the energy of Djuka, who were aware of Brian Jones when they were young in the 60s. And all these people, you know, maximum of 50 people a year, and they all talk to each other and communicate with each other and take each other's addresses. And at the same time, they all get blown away by their experience in the village, because essentially the concept of the festival is very simple. The thing is, what happens in the house is what makes the festival for people. And if the house gives them a connection on the people and the children and the life of the mountains, then everything else falls into place. So it's been a very magical experience over the last number of years. And it also brings extremely important funds into the village at this stage. It's like a harvest.
Though revered literary and rock and roll heroes have come and gone, it seems like Djuka will always remain, with the music and heritage surely inspiring people from all over the world for years to come. For Monocle in Djuka, I'm Saima Tariq.
Mystical. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll hear what it's like when opera comes to your living room in Berlin and meet the man making it his mission to build the UK a brand new world-class art school. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher filled in the gaps. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Ostra with Sleep. Thank you for tuning in.